And now it's time for Freedom Fiends. Have you swallowed too much of the state's poison? The Freedom Fiends will stick their fingers down your throat and hold your hair back while you hurl. And here they are.
Hey, Ben, how you doing?
Pretty good, Michael. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you. It's been a while. I'm really happy that you can talk.
Yeah, it has.
No, you had problems.
Yeah, it was kind of touch and go. I'm actually shocked that I lived to see the new year, because if you had asked me, let's say in late November or early December, and you know, assuming that I thought that you could handle the truth, I would have said, you know, I do not expect to go through December. I my health was so bad at that time that I really didn't expect to see the new year.
Really glad you saw the new year, and you're still not out of the woods, right?
No, I'm still under under heavy, not heavy sedition. Sedition.
The doctor has prescribed heavy sedition and plenty of it.
No, but you know, I'm still being carefully monitored by my cardiologist and by my endocrinologist. Is that right? The guy who takes care of your innards.
Oh, I thought that was the endocrinologist was all about hemorrhoids. hormones.
I don't know. Whoever the doctor is that sends the scope down my throat and looks at my stomach lining and looks at my upper intestines, and that dude. The stomach dude.
Because I had that done at the same time, the same procedure when I got it done from the other end. They did one end, then they did the other end. I'm assuming cleaning the scope or using a different one at some point. But yeah. So what'd they find?
Going down my esophagus, they found a little over 4-inch long tear in the esophagus. And this was coincidentally directly over my heart. So the swelling of the esophagus was literally pushing against my heart.
Oh, man.
And then down inside the stomach, they found a series of tears. And then in the entrance of the upper intestines, they found a series of tears. And so I'm on a protein pump inhibitor, a real powerful one, not the over-the-counter, the kind that you get the little purple pills. But
You got me off of those. I was on those, and didn't you tell me how bad they were? And I went on to, what's the other thing? Zantac instead, and it was much better.
Yeah, they are horrible. They upset the balance of liquids in your body, and you know, it just messes with so many things. But in my situation, it was that or die. You know, because at any moment, the tears could have got to the point of where they just started dumping blood into my system, and it would have taken me down pretty quick. And even if it would have stayed as it was, the esophagus being swollen to the point that it was pushing against the heart. You know, so. It would have got me one way or the other.
So does this have anything to do with the dementia?
It added to it in the sense that, you know, I was in constant pain and constantly fighting the stomach illness. And because of that, the burden on my brain just took me down to where I was basically a mumbling idiot. So it did have that effect. You know, anything pretty much the way dementia
punch drunk.
Punch drunk, yeah, very much.
Pugula something.
The way that works is if I have like a very calm life and I don't have any stress, and I can get good night's sleep and, you know, all that kind of thing, then I'm pretty functional. I mean, it's hard to look at me and tell that there's anything wrong. But then any amount of stress increase causes the brain to just very quickly be overwhelmed, and that can be something simple like we now unfortunately have two dogs, not just one, and they're both old and sickly and rescue dogs. And so the backyard here at our house in Ohio is not safe to just walk across the grass.
You mean because of dog poo, or because they dig holes, or what?
Yeah, yeah, because of dog poo.
So your yard just is kind walking of like, is like Kensington.
Yeah.
Philly. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Steve. Yeah. So just walking across the yard to the other side of the yard and watching for dog manure and coming back to the, you know, back to where I came from, that little simple little exercise will actually cause me to visibly shake because I've had to really watch my step and so forth.
Now, or then, are you still like that? right?
Yeah, I'm that way now. I'll pretty much anything was overwhelming to me. You know, any like driving in traffic would have been a death sentence because I just wouldn't have been able to handle the stress.
It's interesting to me that you and I went through really severe health stuff around the same time and came out of it around the same time. And I, like you, you know, am not all the way out of the woods, but, and I don't want to go into a lot of detail on it here because anyone who's listened to this show has heard more than enough detail about it and they haven't heard enough about you. So we'll talk more about you, but I find that very interesting. And I also, could have died. Doctor said that what I had could be fatal if, you know, if I didn't mind every little thing, like you said, like, you know, shoveling snow for 5 minutes would have been a death sentence.
Yeah.
You know, and now I'm still not shoveling snow, but I couldn't even walk down the stairs for a year down the basement, one flight of stairs to do, you know, the cat poo boxes. For like a year, like my wife had to do that on top of working and doing a lot of other stuff that I couldn't do. We finally ended up like hiring a guy to help with some stuff around the house. And, I mean, not like we don't have a butler or anything, but like, you know, a guy to do like this, the physical labor that I used to do around the house. But I can go downstairs and clean the cat boxes out now. But what I started doing is, I get really out of breath from walking down there and then need to catch my breath before I can walk back up and then need to sit down and catch my breath. But what I've started doing is reading books that are actually printed on paper, which I haven't done in about 15 years. So I have a book downstairs and I do the cat poo and then I sit down there on a chair and read one or two pages of a book and then I'm ready to walk back up the stairs. So it's had a twofold. I'm learning to read again. I like it.
Hey, speaking of books, let me give a shout out to Paul Rosenberg's latest book,
Crypto Hippie. What's
Paul
his website?
Rosenberg.
I'll look it up.
I think it's Crypto Hippie. I think it's .net. I'm not, or maybe .org. I'm not sure now. But he came out just this year with a new book, and it's like really short. It's 55 pages. It's called The New Age of Intelligence. And if you've read my book, which is Sedition, Subversion, and Sabotage Field Manual Number 1, a three-part solution to the state, if you've read that and you'd like something more, Paul Rosenberg's The New Age of Intelligence is kind of like it could have been a chapter of my book. It's that it's that hand in hand. But Paul is like an incredible techno geek type genius, and so he's coming at it from an angle that I intentionally didn't cover in my book. So, as a matter of fact, in the beginning, in like the first section of my book, I specifically say I'm not going to cover like hacker stuff and electronic stuff and that kind of thing and cybersecurity and stuff, because as soon as I'd write it, you know, first off, I'm not good in that area. Second off, as soon as I'd write it, it would be laughably out of date.
What's his book called?
Well, it's called The New Age of Intelligence. Amazon has it. But Paul's book is like, it's almost timeless, even though it's about the techno field and it's, you know, really good and really brief and really intense in what he says, but it's also, you know, pretty timeless. Like the examples that he gives in there could have applied 10 years ago or 100 years ago or 200 years from now. It's really good stuff. Can't say enough good stuff about Paul's book.
Yeah, I looked him up. He has both Crypto Hippie .net and CryptoHippie.com, and they're both him, but neither of them seem to, I can't find his book on either of them. They might be hidden somewhere on it, you know, deep down a few levels, but they're actually for his VPN site. You know, he sells VPN or rents VPN software accounts, and then he also seems to have some other enterprise system and personal system security tools that he offers his services, and it's too much for me to go through it all right now. But if people want to look at it, it's CryptoHippie.com and CryptoHippie.net. And I don't know where to get his book. I don't see it. It's on Amazon, you said?
Yeah, Amazon has it.
All right.
Amazon has a bunch of his books. He's written a bunch of stuff. He's like you, Michael. He's written a bunch of technical stuff, you know, professionally that was not necessarily liberty-oriented, you know, to make a living.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing that I liked about doing a lot of that stuff, you know, doing before I became a libertarian, I did music professionally for a while, did a lot of recording, and wrote books for publishing companies, like, you know, got advances and wrote books and got royalties, nonfiction books and how-to books. And that came in really happy, really handy, because when I came into Liberty, you know, when I was like, okay, now I'm going to do my newly minted libertarian podcast, it didn't sound bad. Like, I already had the skills, the background skills of making media. And so I'm still trying to teach everyone that, but people still forget. I still hear stuff all the time that is not up to snuff. But I really think that the powerful thing that's helping is shame, is using the term bad audio as a hate crime. Steve Miller has started posting that on website, he's a comedian. He listens to a lot of podcasts. Every comedian does a podcast pretty much, even unknown ones. And he'll find ones that he likes and he'll be like, hey, I like your content, but bad audio is a hate crime. And then he'll link creamyradio.audio.com. And that term, bad audio is a hate crime, was something I screamed at Jeremy on air on the radio in anger when he was justifying having done some bad audio on my show, or trying to get it on my show at some point. And Jim Jesus thought it was really funny, and he made bad audio as a hate crime stickers, and they've kind of been flying off the shelves. I think they're the most popular sticker I've ever done.
Well, Michael, I'm sure you recall my early podcasts were just wretched sound quality. Yeah. I had a Zoom sitting on the desk like 4 or 5 feet away from me. And my daughter Kai and I would sit on opposite sides of a desk with the Zoom in the middle. And her voice went up and down because she goes, her vocal, you know, I don't know what you call it, but she'll go from
whisper. She's a very dynamic individual is what you're trying to say.
Yes. Yeah. She'll go from a whisper to
record conversation easily without a compressor.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, you sent me a compressor, I think, mostly because of her, so that we could control her inflections in her voice, because it just, she would blow a mic away and then go straight to a whisper, you know?
Yep, yep.
But you know, by the time you got done coaching me, I was putting out a fairly decent sound most of the time.
Yep, and your stuff's been getting played on radio a bit. I know somebody that's running a community radio station in Wyoming, who's been playing a lot of it. And Cash Newman, my cousin, did an article on the Freedom Fiends called Make a Liberty Radio Station for $120. If people want to Google that, it's probably the first thing that comes up. Or if you search it on Freedom Fiends, it definitely will be the first thing that comes up. I've stopped saying, we'll put this in the show notes. But anyway, like there's a bunch of recommended stuff to play on your community radio, Liberty radio station, and you are one of them. Specifically, I linked a couple of your series. But I've listening to stuff you did like 4 years ago played on radio makes me want to really be careful at being timeless with everything. Like, I'm listening to Ben Stone. He's dropping Mad Science, and then he's like, and folks, I'd like you to come over to our forum. And I'm like, there's no forum. You took the forum down, Ben. and then, you know, there's an ad for something that doesn't exist anymore. And then there's the main thing, though, it's weird on radio is, yeah, and I'll put a note. I'll put the notes for this in the show. I'll put this in the show notes. It's like, I've kind of stopped putting a lot of things in the show notes. I still do once in a while, but anybody can Google anything, and there's so many places a show can get played now other than, you know, someone playing it from the page on a podcast website while they're reading the show notes, that I try to rely as little as necessary on the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of people don't even go to the website. I mean, they get it off of iTunes or wherever, and it just goes straight to their phone, and, you know, they don't even see the website ever.
A lot of people. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are people that subscribe to our podcast, the podcast of the Freedom Fiends, that have never been on the website. And what there's most of is people who've been to the website once, subscribed, and then never come back, but they're listening every day. That's pretty common, because we're not one of those websites that like encourages people to interact. We don't have a forum. You know, if people what they do on forums all the time generally is they make or if you know, I mean, we allow comments, but 3/4 of the comments are people saying, here's what you should do different. Here's what you should do different about your show. And what it really comes down to is they want a different show. You know, so I just tell them, go to creamyradioaudio.com and start your own show, because I've gotten to the point where anytime anybody makes a suggestion, I just say no, just one answer. And they generally get kind of upset. Then I have a cut and paste I give them of, like, you know, Freedom Fiends, the radio I control, not you. You know, it's not Free Talk Live. This is, I don't want any input from people. I make the show I want. And if people want to listen, fine. If they don't, fine.
That was kind of my thoughts when I got rid of the forum at Bad Quaker. Yeah.
It was just complaints, wasn't it? You complained to me about that. It was just complaints back then.
Yeah, and forums kind of, like, they had their day and they had a purpose at one point, but now they're kind of a dinosaur, and all they are is an irritation.
Yeah,
you know, and even there, like, one of the things that caused me to kill it was David Friedman. David Friedman being the son of Milton Friedman. And both these guys are geniuses. I'm not going to say that, you know, like, oh, he's an idiot. No, he's not. He's a genius. David Friedman is amazing. But I said something in passing about him in a podcast, and comparing, I was talking about a Murray Rothbard had written a thing essentially attacking him, like, way back in the early 80s. And so I commented about it, that Murray was actually wrong about some of the things that he said. But David Friedman didn't hear that. I mean, he heard it. You know how you hear something, but it doesn't actually go in your brain.
He heard the part all he wanted heard, to hear.
Exactly, which was one slight criticism of David Friedman. And onto my forum he comes, and it turns into just pages of he and I going back and forth. And eventually I won on, you know, on paper, so to speak. I won. But then
says you.
The funny, yes.
He says he's right now telling someone, yeah, and this Ben Stone, I mean, I won. Ben Stone lost.
But he got me back, because we were both at Porkfest one year, both speaking and, like, one tent apart. And, you know, the big tent, is anybody who's never been to Porkfest, they have these big giant, like, circus tents that they put out, and people have a stage and you get up there and talk. So we were like 1 hour off from each other. He had just finished his talk.
Weed and
I was
circus.
About to start mine. Yeah, exactly. And so he spots me from across this big field and waves his arms and yells my name and just starts waddling as fast as his big old fat butt would let him waddle. And I say that, you know, Michael, you know me, I'm heavy, you know, I'm
not
fat,
svelte.
But yeah, but David Friedman is shaped kind of this pear shape. So the top half of his body looks normal size, but you get down to his butt, you know, anyway.
That, yeah.
So he's just wiggling as fast as he can wiggle across this field. It looks so comical. And he comes up to me and he shakes my hand, tells me, you know, it's an honor to meet you. And I'm the same way. I mean, this guy is famous. He's the one that he basically made Renaissance festivals cool back in the day.
That's not good. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So we stand there and talk for a minute and exchange pleasantries, and we get all done. I said, hey, I hate to break this off. I have like 2 minutes and I have to be on stage,
and then
I'd love for you to come in.
Unpleasantries.
Yeah. Well, no, he just totally blew me away. He says, you know, I'm like, come on in, I'll get you a good seat. And he looks at me, says, oh, Ben, there's nothing you could say that I haven't heard already. And he spins around on his feet and gone. And I'm standing there. He did this to me right before I go on stage at one of the biggest crowds I've ever spoke to. And he did that to me. And I know he did it on purpose, and he won. His intent was to come over, be friendly, insult me, and walk away right before I go on stage. And it was perfect. Now, the only thing, and so he won, but the only thing that he didn't know was that I have brain damage in such a way that in like 5 minutes, I forget that I'm nervous. And so I go back on stage and it never even affected me. But from a tactical point of view, it was brilliant on his part. He could not have staged it any better if he sat down and planned it.
Wow. I did that to somebody one time. What he did to you. But I didn't do it intentionally. I didn't do it to win. I did it because I thought they were wrong and I thought I was right. And it's a really embarrassing story for me now, because it was Dave Navarro from Jane's Addiction when he played with the Red Hot Chili Peppers. You know, it was, he did like one record and a couple tours with them, and then I thought it was, it's my favorite Chili Peppers. I love that record, but a lot of Chili Peppers fans, it's their least favorite record. But I was buddies with their manager, and he got me backstage at three shows in San Francisco and Sacramento during that tour. Not just backstage, but on stage. I was actually sitting on stage at the Cow Palace, leaning up against Flea's bass amp during the show. The first show I did, they did in the middle of this long set, long great set, the singer left the stage, looked kind of embarrassed, left the stage, and then the three of them, guitar, bass, and drummer, did a song without the singer, with Dave Navarro, the guitarist, singing. And the song was Heroin by the Velvet Underground. And this is when the whole band was like in early recovery. And, you know, one of the many times they were in early recovery. And I was in early recovery too. And I was in that early kind of recovery where like you're insane and think that, you know, like someone who really has a lot of recovery is like, yeah, I can't do that stuff, but I don't care if other people do. But I was like, you know, if I'd thought of it, I probably would have written my congressman and told him, you know, death sentence for a drug. No, I wasn't like that. I wasn't like there need to be a law, because I understood even before I was officially a libertarian how the laws hurt people. But I thought it was a bad influence on the kids for them to do that song. And the next time I thought about it for two or three days, and then I saw them again in Sacramento and was backstage, and I went and borrowed a legal pad, yellow pad of paper and a pen from some PA or something backstage, and wrote this like long, heartfelt, self-righteous, insanely self-righteous, like 1.5 legal pages, handwritten letter to Dave Navarro telling him why he shouldn't, why I thought he shouldn't play that because it was a bad influence on the kids. And I handed it to him. You know, I just happened to like be where he was, walking by him backstage. And I said, here, this is for you. I'm a friend of Louis. This is for you. And I said, I'm a friend of Louis. I'm Michael Dean. And I want to give you this. And I think you should read it. And I handed it to him. You know, I thought he'd throw it away or, you know, read it weeks later or something when the tour was over. But he comes up to me. This was like an hour before they went on stage, maybe. And he came up to me like 15 minutes before they went on stage and got like right up in my face, like a foot away, looked me in the eye and said, I can't believe you gave me this right before I went on stage. This totally messes me up going on stage. I mean, it's not gonna, because I'm a professional, but you know, you really shouldn't have done this. This was totally uncool. And I was like, I'm sorry, man. I just really felt strongly about it. I didn't know when else I'd be able to let you know. And he's like, well, you know, Louis, you could have given it to him anytime. I could have read it anytime, except when I'm going to go on stage. You don't do that to a performer, man. And he walked off. And they did a great show. And then the third show, I saw him again the next night in Sacramento, and they didn't do that song anymore. And I asked Louis about it, and he's like, oh, yeah, they just decided to take it out of the, you know, had nothing to do with you. And I'm like,
out of the rotation.
Yeah, it had something to do with me, you know, because they're all in early recovery. And I think that the singer, you know, left the stage because he's like, I want nothing to do with this, you know. Like he was in the earliest recovery of all of them. So that was my story of bumming out a performer. Yeah.
I have two comments on that. First off, you exactly described a newly minted libertarian who decides that they need to tell you all about the Federal Reserve.
Or the anonymous. Or why you shouldn't say,
there's no such thing as hate crimes.
Yeah, like when they, that's the thing, like the bad audio is a hate crime sticker. I've actually had a few newly minted libertarians post or tell me, there's no such thing as a hate crime. Like, duh, that's the joke, man.
Or
you have that thing about on sheep, by sheep. You shouldn't call them sheep.
Bah. Have you heard that? I haven't heard that, but that's funny.
Yeah.
That's actually a really popular button, the one that you made. It's called, for people that don't know, it's a button we used to have. I don't know if we have it anymore. I can't remember. Do we? I don't know. I change the buttons from time to time. Let me open up a button pack and look at it. Let's see.
Yeah, it was buy sheep for sheep on sheep.
We still have it. Yeah. It's a big button now. Cool. There's some big and some are small now.
It's some are big and some are small. Yeah. I love that. That thing Steve Miller never did. Yeah. I love that.
So that's, he's good at those little songs.
To the sung to the tune of Green Acres.
Yep. Yep.
Green Buttons. I love that.
I love it too. He also does a really funny one. Something to the tune of Golden Girls, I think.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Thank you for being a fiend.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the other thing, when you very first started your story, before you revealed that it was Dave that you had done that to, I almost interrupted you and said, who did you do that to? Like, you know, and then name somebody like from Led Zeppelin or The Who or somebody, because I knew that's where you were going to take that story.
You knew it had to be someone that like to somebody in the top 10 of the charts playing in Normo Dome to like 25,000 people.
Like the Cow Palace. Like a lot of people back east won't know about that. But if you've lived anywhere near the Bay Area in California, you know the Cow Palace.
Yeah, the Cow Palace was the first night, and then I saw them two nights at the Cow Palace, and then the third night where they stopped doing it, actually. No, it was one night at the Cow Palace, and then two nights at the Sacramento Event Center, I think, which I think is even bigger than the Cow Palace, maybe. Let me look it up.
When I lived in San Jose in the late 60s, early 70s, I think the Cow Palace was the largest venue in that whole area, maybe in all of Northern California. There were a couple of real famous places, you know, Winterland was there. And what was that other one? I can't remember now.
The Warfield? No, not the Warfield. The one down in the God, what is the name of the place? I saw Jane's Addiction there. Yeah, that place. I mean, it's the Fillmore.
Yeah. Fillmore. Yeah, that's it. Fillmore.
Oh,
later there was a Fillmore East, but the original Fillmore was there in San Francisco.
Sacramento Event Center holds 19,000 people, and these shows were all sold out too. Cow Palace. Man, Google is getting really, really smart. Like, I just either that or it's just listening to everything we say on the Android phone that's next to me, because I searched the event center, Sacramento Event Center, which is called something else now, and I searched capacity, and then I searched Cow PAL, and it autofilled Cow Palace capacity. So,
wow.
So it's 12,000, 13,000. So yeah, they weren't that as big as I thought. It was 13,000 and 19,000, not 20,000 and 25,000, but you know, close enough for rock and roll. Literally.
I watched, I've rewatched Tenacious D and what's the
Pick of Destiny.
The Pick of Destiny. Yeah, I watched that last night and I was laughing. The song, I think it's the wrap up song where they, you know, punk tried to kill it, but they couldn't. And grunge tried to kill it, but they couldn't. It was pretty funny. I was thinking about you, Michael.
That's an interesting movie in that it's a really good movie, but it's also so consciously following the hero's journey that it's almost a parody of them. I mean, even to the point of that it's called The Pick of Destiny and it's about a particular guitar pick, because a big part of the hero's journey is the talisman that's given to you by the mentor.
And the vision in the beginning.
Yeah, and the mentor is supposed to be somebody who is used to be at the height of the game you're trying to enter, but now they're not the height anymore because they're crippled in some way. Either they're, you know, alcoholic or went crazy and I think it wasn't the guy that gave him the pick, like some I think it was I think it was Tim Robbins playing a German hippie who had been, what is it, like a roadie for Motorhead or something, and he was limping. Like, you know, the hero has, you know,
had his leg cut off.
The mentor has to have some problem. Okay, we'll make him limp. I mean, it was that by the numbers, but it's still a really good movie.
Yeah. Well, you know, knowing the hero's journey can foul up the magic of watching something like that, but also you can kind of ride along with it and see it happening and know exactly what they're doing as they're doing it. It's kind of you know, a little bit of inside baseball type stuff.
I mean, Hollywood does it a lot of times to the point that, I mean, somebody should actually make a website if they haven't already that's called the Hero's Journey Calculator, where you put in how many minutes a movie is and it shows you a timeline of what events are going to happen at what minute mark. And I'd be willing to bet that if you work that out mathematically, you could get it pretty close to like within 1 or 2 minutes either way. You know, like end of act one, beginning of act two, end of act two, beginning of act three, you know, meeting the mentor, being given the talisman by the mentor later in act three, like having to like pull the talisman out to win the battle in the innermost chamber, things like that, the denouement, all of that stuff. Like there's minute marks for it in Hollywood movies.
You know, I mentioned Lord of the Rings earlier, and one of the things I think that is so powerful about that story is that Tolkien took like four heroes' journeys and just overlapped them on each other, and so you have this same thing happening in kind of four different realms at the same time. And it can be like some people, I was trying to remember who it was. I know who it was. It was Jack, what's his name? Jack Nicholson.
Oh,
no, old time actor, Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
Or is he the golfer?
Jack Nicholson.
No, that's Nicholas.
Jack Nicholas is the golfer, I think.
So Jack Nicholas, his reason that he didn't like Lord of the Rings
who'd
was,
you say is the actor?
Jack Nicholson?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah. So his complaint with Lord of the Rings was that it had like seven endings. And it did, because they had to wrap up, Tolkien had to wrap up each of the hero's journey separately. And each time it was an ending for the movie.
Are you talking about within one of the movies or between all three of those movies?
Well, there was
book.
One
you're
for
talking
each.
About the book.
Yeah, well, if you follow the book, it has even more more of these layered on top of each other. But he was talking about the movie, and in the final third movie, it had like four endings, and that's what frustrated him, because he understood exactly what we're talking about. He knows all that stuff, and so when it got to the first hero's ending, then he's like, yeah, the movie should be over, but no, we got another hour.
Well, I could see him being kind of square in that way, even though he's a hip dude and he's been, you know, I mean, if you take like a movie like Easy Rider, which was a cutting edge movie, broke a bunch of rules, you know, they were actually taking acid in it in the acid scenes. You'd think, well, that probably doesn't follow the hero's journey, but nope, that follows the hero's journey, you know, to a T. I'm sure that most of the movies, if not all the movies that he's been in, follow that. And you know, he just thought Lord of the Rings was too weird for him, because it was, you know what, it's kind of like that kind of writing of overlapping hero's journeys ending for different characters. Do you remember that old BS in the 70s called biorhythms?
Oh yeah.
I remember one of the first uses of a consumer computer was like in the mid to late 70s. You could buy for like $8,000, you could buy a hardware unit that would track your biorhythms. Now, biorhythms were hoodoo science from, I don't know when it started, but it was, let me search it real quick here. Biorhythm.
It was up there with crystals and your aura and your horoscope. And
yeah, it was
in the age of Aquarius.
I don't know when it was an attempt to predict people's life cycles. It was developed in the late 19th century, popularized in the United States in the late 70s. Many scientists believe the idea had no predictive power other than chance, and considered an example of pseudoscience. So the theory was that the day you're born, and then throughout your whole life, the day you're born, these three cycles start. And that there's a physical cycle that's 23 days, an emotional cycle that's 28 days, and an intellectual cycle that's 33 days. So like, you know, people would use sine wave equations to calculate this for their whole lives. And you know, like it went in a sine wave, like up and down and up and down throughout that cycle, and then started over. And the idea was that like you know, like businessmen and athletes would have this done and then try to like only schedule meetings on the day when like, you know, all three cycles were going to be more toward the top, and then, you know, only take their day, you know, never do anything important on the days when they're down. But my belief with it is that, And I realized this when I was like 11 and heard about this. It was that if such a thing exists, it would be different for different people, the same way that not every woman's menstrual cycle is the same, and not everyone's, I mean, that's actually more locked in time than I think these schedules would be. Like sleep schedules. Like, I do not have a 24-hour sleep cycle. And I know this because I have not had to get up for a day job in about, since about the year 2001, when my $30 film school book came out. Actually, before that, no, in the year 2000, when my DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist film came out. Since then, I've never had to have a full-time or a day job, you know, where I have to get up to an alarm. I've been self-employed in one aspect or another. If I'm working for other people, it's at home and on my own time. So I live on the schedule I live on. I mean, I go to sleep when I want. I get up when I want. And over a period of time, I've never actually even written it down to map it out, but I would guess it's probably about every month and a half to 2 months, I completely flip schedules. Like, you know, right now, like today I got up at 5:30 in the morning, you know, and in a month and a half, I'll be getting up at 5:30 at night. Or actually, a couple days ago, I was getting up at 5:30 at night. Sometimes it just switches suddenly too. It just did that yesterday, but it was because the cycle got upset because I had to get up for a workman that was coming to the house. So I only got 4 hours sleep. So I went to bed a lot earlier than I normally would. But yeah, it's not the normal human 24-hour cycle. Part of it is because I don't see the sun that much. But even when I like, it's a sunny, beautiful day and I'm in my room with the curtains drawn because the sun melts my eyes.
No, I started to mention that the sun probably has a lot to do with that because that's more pronounced.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's more pronounced. You know, like people who live in the northern parts of Alaska and work up there, their time cycles are all whacked out.
Yeah. Well, this, Wyoming is definitely, I mean, it's not nearly as far north as Alaska, but we definitely have less hours average per day than we did in Southern California. I mean, we have, I think I looked it up one time. I think it was about like 25 minutes a day average per year, less sunlight than we have in Southern California. And that's enough to make a difference. That's enough to make you feel it. And also combined with extreme wind and extreme cold to where, you know, it's hard to go out and party outdoors a lot of the year. But I don't get depressed. I do not get depressed from it. I just live on my own schedule.
The angle of the sun is dramatically different where you're at from Southern California too. I noticed that in Southern Alabama, that the sun itself is just way more intense than up here in Ohio, where it has to go through, you know, a tighter angle. And then in addition to that, it's going through more atmosphere to get here because of that angle.
Yep. But it's not going through smog like it is in Southern California. I don't know,
it's surprisingly bad in Ohio.
I'd believe it. It's a horrible place. The other thing that I thought when I was a kid and realized, the other truth I realized about the biorhythms not being true, is that let's say everyone does really have all these things, and let's say everyone does average the same amount of time, you know, days in their three cycles, which is unlikely, but let's say they do, it wouldn't stay the same. You know, like if you had an accident or you had a traumatic event or you stayed up 3 days working or partying or something, or you were sick, it would change, just like your sleep schedule, women's menstrual cycles, you know, any human cycle changes when it's upset, when your homeostasis is upset. You want to talk about homeos? Yeah. I like homeos. Let's talk about that. That's what I call them. So yeah, you were laughing, Ben, because I was explaining homeostasis and you're like, I think I know what that is. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go to the bathroom. You Google it and then create a Liberty story around it, a Liberty parable. And I muted my mic and walked away, and DJ was laughing her head off in the other room because I said that. So do it. Go. What is homeostasis, first of all? Do you want to read a definition or you got one?
I could read. I'm on the Wikipedia page for it. It's basically a mammal's ability to maintain its body temperature and like the pH of its fluids in its body and the sodium levels and the calcium levels and the glucose levels and blood plasma and that kind of thing. There was a lot of talk about it back like in 2007 or 2008, somewhere back in there in the prepper world, that, you know, in order to stay alive, you have to be able to, you know, regulate your body temperature, keep the right, not just food, not just calorie intake, but you have to, you know, maintain the type of calories that are going to not just, you know, keep your heart pumping, but will actually keep your whole body regulated properly. And there was a lot of teaching back then, and in I don't know what's going on in the prepper world now because I haven't been around those people in a long time. But at that time, this was a topic that they were talking about, that, you know, your body can only do so much in regulating itself. You kind of have to help it by things like shelter and proper nutrition and stuff. And a lot of the preppers early on, you know, the old saying is beans, bullets, and bullion, and Band-Aids. And that's great, but that'll only keep you alive for a couple months. I mean, you could have an endless supply of beans, and eventually you're going to starve to death because it's not a rounded diet. You won't actually starve to death, but things will start to break down because your body can only do so much. So you need a more balanced prepping environment. And there, you know, so that was going on back then in 2008, around that time. But yeah, there probably is a good, if I'd really look at it, there probably is a good liberty-based lesson to be learned from that. It's I don't know that I'm fully up for it at the drop of a hat, but yeah, I just got invaded by a dog.
How's your dog?
How you doing?
Yeah, we've got two elderly dogs now. Nikki, the one that we had at Pork Fest that a lot of people are familiar with, had her around during the old podcast days. But now we have Meat. That's his shortened name. His actual name is Meatwad, but he's an elderly, broken up, old, arthritic.
Like us.
Like us, very much. You watch him go up and down stairs, and you're like, yep, that's me.
Yeah,
poor old hips kind of wobbling weird. And yeah, and you can tell when the weather changes here. We had a dramatic barometric pressure change in the last week, and you could just watch him, the way he got up, the way he moved around. And I'm thinking, yeah, I got that. I feel that.
Yep,
I know exactly what you're doing there.
I remember hearing my parents, especially my mother, say when I was, you know, 25 or something. No, I was, what, 15, less, 10. And she was, my parents are older than me, than most parents are than their kids. I was a happy accident after they had three kids in college, in high school and college. My mother was 40 and my dad was 43 when I was born. So, you know, by the time I was 10, and they'd worked themselves not to death, but to ill health. I mean, my mother lived to 75. My dad is still alive at 95. My mother died of cancer. But, you know, they all worked. They both worked like 80, 90, 100 hours a week their whole life, running their own businesses. You know, and that, even if it's not physical labor, although before that they'd lived on a farm together. And, you know, you probably think, oh, farm, it's great life. Like, no, but they were starving on a farm, and they had like little kids too. Like they, you know, bought a farm, didn't really know what to do with it, or just sort of knew what to do with it, but like, you know, didn't have the resources to really like make it a, you know, feed yourself farm for the first couple of years. I mean, they had cows for milk. You know, they were not meat cows. They weren't slaughtering them. They were having milk cows. And then they had an apple tree. And like the first year, they pretty much lived on like apples and milk. But and then, you know, like just worked themselves to the bone. So like by the time I was 10, when my mother was 50, you know, she was having a lot of aches and pains. And I remember her just saying, like, you know, don't ever get old. It's horrible. And kind of laugh, but kind of be serious. And I'm like, what does that mean? Die young? And she's like, no. Just, you'll know when you get to be my age. And I'm 53 now, and I've had a lot of health issues. You know, a lot of people are 53 are still pretty healthy, but I'm not. And I know exactly what you meant now. Yeah.
Yeah, we rode our bodies hard and put them away wet, as they say about a horse. But, you know, when I was 17. I'm not going to go into the whole story because I know, Michael, you like to regulate how much illegal activity is talked about.
I like to keep you out of prison, Ben. You've done pretty well so far.
But,
You ever been to
but
jail?
I had been involved.
I've never asked you that.
I've done overnight stenches, but
yeah,
but,
me too. Once,
yeah, but I got involved in this thing where me and some friends actually ripped off the mob for something close to $30,000 worth of goods, and I was standing. I thought we had completely gotten away with it.
The mob could mean anything, too. You know, it's not like the Italians from New York City are going to come visit you tomorrow saying this.
It's not like I'm specifically talking about a Sicilian family from Northern California that owns a winery.
Yes, or Eastern New Jersey.
But anyway, I thought we got away with it because there was a police raid like the next day on this same location, and I thought they wiped out all evidence of what we had done. But what I didn't know was the Bakersfield, California newspaper ran a story, and they confused me with my brother, and they ran my name as being involved with this whole situation, and that popped me up on these guys' radar. And I didn't even know this had happened. I didn't read the newspaper at the time, so I didn't know. So I'm standing. I had been working on my car in my mom and dad's driveway, and my typical uniform of the day was short cut off Levi type pants and no shoes, no shirt. That's just it. It was short cut off Levi pants, and that's it. Sometimes I wore underwear, but. So I was covered in head to toe with grease from working on my car, and I had gotten some, my dad always had industrial hand cleaner. So I had gotten some of that and got myself all, you know, greased up with this hand cleaner. And I was standing in the, at the end of the driveway, standing on my left foot, holding a water hose with my right foot, like it was a hand. And I'm using the water hose and washing my hands and washing my body with holding the hose, you know, like you've seen people with no arms, how articulate they can be with their feet. Well, I was like that with my feet at the time. I could pick things up. I could, you know, I could scratch my forehead with my toes. I was really super flexible. And I was very muscular at the same time. I worked out constantly, and I was pretty big too, you know, muscle wise. And I look back at that now. I almost missed the rest of the story. So I'm standing there at the end of the driveway, holding this hose with my foot, standing on the other foot, washing my hands, and a stretch Mercedes pulls up right in front of me. The blacked out windows, the back window rolls down, this massive guy sitting in there looks around at me, and this old man leans over past him, so he kind of appears behind him and says something to the big guy, and the window goes back up and the car drives away. And I thought, oh crap, I'm dead. Because I knew what just happened. They just positively identified me and said, yeah, that's the guy. So real quick, I run in the house and I grab my go bag, and I grab a couple other things, throw them in my car, and boom, I'm out of there. I'm all the way up in Fresno by the time anybody knew where I was. But the moral of my story was that was me at like 17 or 18, whatever it was. And within 10 years of that, you know, I've got compressed discs in my back. I've got arthritis starting to form in my neck. I'm on a 10-pound weight limitation from back injuries. And, you know, it just goes downhill from there. It's like, man, age just beats you and beats you and beats you and then laughs at you as you die.
Yeah, I kind of...
Isn't that a wonderful story?
It is. So the go bag is what you use to maintain your homeostasis, right?
Yeah.
DJ and I use the word homeos to describe homeostasis, and also to like describe the state of being home and happy together. Like our homeos are good, you know, when we're all of our holes are filled, you know, food, love, entertainment, cats, no problems, all of it. The homeos are well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's important.
So drop some bad liberty science, Ben. Why don't you tell me? Why don't you tell me for what do you mean? Oh man, liberty, the stuff I've been talking about nonstop for decades. Ugh.
You know, I saw coming where we are in something like 2011 or 2012.
The episode or in our lives.
As far as the liberty so-called movement.
Wait, you got a mouse in your pocket? Are you, there's a new verb for that now. Are you mouse pocketing me, Ben? Who's this we?
No, actually, when I was thinking of we, it was me, you, and Nima talked about
That works.
Probably 2012 or so, we were talking about the Liberty Movement.
The private and we instead of the royal me, we. I like it.
And at the time, we were making fun of the Liberty Movement, saying, yeah, I had a movement this morning.
Yeah,
it's a lot like, you know, because we could actually see a lot of these things coming, like this weird twist to the alt-right that took place in the last year. We didn't necessarily have the terminology, but all three of us, you, I, and Nima, talked about this, knowing that it's coming, knowing these guys are unstable. We almost could have picked them out by name, you know, at the time. And sure enough, each one of them that we knew and when we talked about, whether it's, you know, the he who cannot be named or the other he who we prefer not to name or the other he that we don't want to give any mic time to.
So wait, I'm guessing you're saying in order, Cantwell, Molyneux, and Jeff Berwick. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and you could even expand it further to say like Kokesh and the second levels that are not necessarily pure.
You used to like Kokesh, didn't you? I don't like him anymore. He's a goofball.
I liked him a little bit until I saw the way he treated his dog, and then I was like,
"Wow,
not a good guy."
How did he treat his dog? That's interesting.
He just was yanking him around and just really rough with him. I mean, he wasn't like beating him or anything.
You know, I'll bet if you asked him, he'd say, hey, the dog is my property and I'm not violating the non-aggression principle. If I did this to your dog, it'd be wrong, but it's my dog. I could just see him saying that.
That would probably be his defense. But yeah.
Well,
he really
make fun of him. We'll straw man him, but it'll be an accurate straw man because I think he'd really do that.
For me, he jumped the shark with his whole March on D.C. thing. When he started that, I thought, you know, you couldn't have come up with a stupider idea. I mean, if you sat down with a committee of idiots and said, hey, let's find out the dumbest thing we could do. And then he blundered and bungled the whole thing. And it's like nobody even caught on what he had done. And then they all rallied behind him because now he's in jail. Oh, wow. He did something idiotic and got himself thrown in jail. And so we should what? Send him money? I don't think so.
I know.
But of all the people that we just mentioned, he's probably the least dishonest of the group. Because others in that group are just outright
flaky. He's flaky to the point of being. I actually want to get off this topic of naming people. Really, this is like a typical Freedom Fiends. I don't want to go into this with you, unless you really have a need to. Do you?
Nah. Okay. No, so they just disgust
in
me
a bigger way. So I think I'm going to call this episode something like Ben Stone. Let's see, something about us jumping over Liberty, jumping the shark. Can you check your email? I just sent you the image for it. It's kind of funny because while you were talking, this is the picture that I was manipulating with Photoshop and putting a border on. Can you see it?
Yeah, cat and the shark.
Yeah, it's a cat. It's our cat Bippy, Bipcat, the Bipcoin logo model in a little cat house that's like a plush kind of toy house thing with a pillow in it that is a shark. It's really cute. It's adorable. Yeah.
That I think my only point in all that was that we could see that stuff coming. And then when not just the named libertarians, not the, you know, the celebritarians, not just those guys, but the wave of people who call themselves anarchists or call themselves ANCAPs or libertarians or whatever, that just totally fell for the whole 2016 election. It was like that instantly, that useless piece of drama became really important to these people, and they thought that it meant something. And it was just saddening.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting that you said that we're talking about, you said that you liked Adam Kokesh until you saw how he treated his dog, because it reminds me of something that someone said one time to me a long time ago, and they said, anarchists just want to beat their dogs and their women and get away with it. I don't think it's true. And they were specifically talking about left anarchists, not voluntarist anarchists. But I still think it's kind of funny. I just could totally see that justification.
Yeah. Yeah, because so many of them fit that description.
Yep.
That's kind of like when somebody says, well, a libertarian is just a Republican on weed. And you, first off, you want to say, no, you don't understand. But then you actually step back and start looking at the people who call themselves libertarian. And you go, yeah, Gary Johnson, that is exactly Gary Johnson.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And he's not even a good Republican, if there is such a thing.
Yeah.
He's just confused, man. Yeah. You know, that's I try to make every episode not just for the people we know and love, but also a little bit for the people who've never heard these concepts, because these will get played on radio. These will get played places that, you know, people didn't find them specifically, and they're not people who usually right. listen to them. So I want to talk a little about principles. And we are libertarians. I'd say I'm an anarcho-capitalist. I'd say I'm a voluntarist. Would you be offended at being called any of those things, Ben?
I generally try not to call myself anarcho-capitalist, because both words, anarchy and capitalism, are so horribly twisted.
Yeah.
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 I watched a debate the other day, I think I watched it on YouTube, if I remember, among a couple celebritarians, and they got off on arguing about the word capitalism, and it was so ridiculous from line one. They were talking right past each other, and they, it wasn't just that they could agree, okay, this is what I mean by it when I say it, okay, fine, well, this is what I mean by it. It wasn't like that. It was like they had to try to convince the other one to accept their version of what they were saying.
That's so
common, so it became...
Man.
Yeah, it's what you see almost every time. So it became a completely useless debate between two airheads who neither one would stop and actually listen to what the other one was saying. I had finally just turned it off.
Back when I was a newly minted libertarian, and actually a few times out of my mouth came the phrase, libertarians are just Republicans that want to smoke pot. I didn't believe that, really, but that's like what I'd tell my dad, although it didn't work with my dad because he thought that sounded horrible. But, you know, I've used that with some liberals, and, you know, they get hung up on the Republican part. And I realize that, like, none of it's really accurate about true libertarians. It's probably true about a lot of people in the Libertarian Party. But back when I was a newly minted libertarian, I remember saying and joking and getting a lot of people, like, this is before Facebook, this was probably on MySpace or probably on a podcast, and I got comments, like thumbs up kind of the comments, and it was, I said that libertarians are people who agree 99.5% on everything and fight to the death over the other 0.5%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fairly accurate.
Yep. It's more accurate than libertarians are. Well, the death part isn't true, but, you know, how about this? Libertarians are people who agree 99% of the time and spend the rest of the time bickering about the other 1%. That'd be a more succinct and accurate way of saying it. And it's certainly more accurate than libertarians are just Republicans who want to smoke pot.
Yeah. Or the other worn out phrase where they say, well, we're socially liberal and fiscally conservative.
Yeah.
And that's not, no, that just means you're mixed up and don't know what you're doing.
You see, what happened was the Libertarian Party in the 70s formed and was a bold new idea. The idea that there should be less government, that, you know, things that didn't have a victim shouldn't be against the law. And it was groundbreaking, although it didn't break much ground. So it kind of like sat around getting half of one. What's that? What's that noise?
I muted my mic there. My elderly dog is having COPD.
All right. Well, I'm going to rant for a minute so you can mute it some more, because it sounds like geese.
It does.
I love you and I like your dog, but I don't want to hear him while I'm ranting. He sounds like I sounded last year, and that bums me out. So the Libertarian Party was amazing for its time. They were doing the best they could with what they had. And I say that about a lot of people throughout history. Like, you know, who's the writer?
Mises did the best.
Yeah, yeah.
Mises did the best he had, you said.
Right, and so did... who's the writer that got shot out of a cannon after he died?
Oh, yeah. Gonzo Reporter.
Yeah, Gonzo guy. Who's the Gonzo Reporter, DJ? Why can I never remember this? Yeah. I want to say William
S. Burroughs. My cousin actually knew him.
That's not it.
But no, yeah. No. Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah, Hunter S. Thompson. He did the best. You know, he was basically an anarchist and a libertarian, but he ran for mayor or sheriff of Aspen, Colorado County, whatever it is, under a platform of, like, you know, legalized drugs and guns, which is very libertarian, that those two things together, because usually, you know, one party wants to do one and not the other and vice versa. But, you know, to say both. But he also said You know, but he also was kind of right wing, and people thought of him as kind of right wing, like he was the right wing guy that the leftist liked, kind of like Ted Nugent back in the day before he became a character. Like I'm talking like Rolling Stone magazine opinion of these people.
Yeah.
You know, he was like
probably closer to Zappa.
Yeah. Who was very libertarian, but was also another like doing the best he could with what he had, because he really like kind of like was in trying to change laws like really hard, yeah, and banging his head against the wall, and went to his grave not making a difference, but just being himself made a difference. But
yeah,
Gonzo guy, his platform was all drugs will be legal to give away, but if you sell them, it's the death penalty. What kind of communist BS is that, man? But anyway,
yeah. So again, doing the best he could with what he had.
Yeah. And so what happened was then people would join the Libertarian Party in the 70s and 80s and be like a little crazier, like, hey, you know, I don't want to wear a tie. I want to wear a T-shirt, and I don't want to be quiet and talk responsibly with Robert's Rules of Order. I want to go out and rabble rouse and shake things up. And this thing happened called Macho Flash Libertarians. It was what it was. There was an article. If you search that, there's like it was like something that was on a printed mimeograph newsletter. People don't even know what that is. Mimeographed. It was a way of printing words onto paper. You know, it was like, and somebody typed it on the internet at some point. You can find it. There's one place it's on the internet. I should probably mirror it before it goes away. It's an article about don't be a macho flash libertarian. And basically that was people who, you know, while the Libertarian Party was saying we need to work within the system to decriminalize and tax marijuana, you know, because that's kind of like the thing they thought would work for the squares of, well, you know, if you tax it, you'll make money instead of realizing, hey, taxation is theft. I love that that has caught on. That's one of the new things that I really like. And I think Lou helped create that term or like publicize it early on. I think he was like patient one, if not patient zero with that.
The same thing with longer leash thing.
Yeah, that's definitely his. That's
a lot of people have run with that.
And people who don't even know him are the fiends. But yeah, Lou's a quiet little meme factory. He's come up with some other ones too. I can't remember what, but offhand.
He was talking the longer leash thing at like restaurants with Libertarian Party people.
Oh, yeah, and, with like five people there. I've seen a cell phone video of that. I didn't watch it all because it's bad audio. It was a hate crime, but that was the title of it. Yeah, someone else filmed it. It was bad audio. But the Macho Libertarian Flash people, the Macho Flash Libertarian, I changed it at some point in my head and called it Macho Libertarian Flash, which actually rolls off the tongue better. And it's instead of the article was condemning the people, Macho Flash Libertarians, I call the thing, the quality of being that and having that, Macho Libertarian Flash, which I think rolls off the tongue better and sounds better and is kind of become the thing. Like if you Google that, you're going to get hundreds of hits because I've been yakking about it for years. And if you Google the original thing, you're going to get one hit, if not zero at this point. So that was a good thing that Macho Flash Libertarians with Macho Libertarian Flash came about, but they kind of got drummed out of the Libertarian Party for the most part. Although there's more now, like there's some like James Weeks, Freedom Fiend, who took his clothes off on national television at a Libertarian Party event. I love that. I think that's the most important thing that's ever happened with the Libertarian Party. I really do.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right there. That, cause I think that more people heard about that than most things libertarians do. But so the Libertarian Party has actually been growing a lot. Historically, they've only gotten 1% of the vote. And this time in this presidential election, they got like between 4 to 6% of the vote with Gary Johnson, which is Gary Johnson's a goofball, but just as a concept for liberty, like that's kind of mind blowing. But even so, that's not going to change the world. And even if you did get a majority, it's still not going to change the world because Congress would become, you know, would become a filibuster about what exactly is the dot in the I at the end of the sentence of the non-aggression principle or something, you know?
Yeah.
They wouldn't get anything done. But, and even so, like the point is not to get things done through politics. The idea is to get things done by making people not want the government and not demand that quote unquote product. Can you talk a little more to that? Oh, wait, before we do though. So I kind of think that the Macho Libertarian, I don't want to say the Macho Libertarian Flash thing has gone too far with brutalism and the alt-right, but I think that it has gone in the wrong direction. You know, it's basically gone back towards fascism, which is what libertarianism is trying to get away from. And I mean, if you want to play a funny little semantics game, and I don't really like to do this, but I think it's kind of important in this case, the word libertarian is a word formed as an antonym to the word authoritarian. Libertarian, the word authoritarian existed forever, and then someone created the word libertarian, meaning the opposite of authoritarian. So if you're alt-right with some libertarian, you know, memories in your head, you're not libertarian because you're going back towards authoritarian. And the same thing with some of the non-alt-righty people that are kind of just really, just, I don't even know if I'd say dark. Like, but what the thing I came up with recently was like, okay, we're in a society, the libertarians that we are, where it's common to say, I think that assault rifles should be available along with crack cocaine in vending machines across the street from the privately owned middle school. That I believe, and I'm not just being macho libertarian flash, I really believe it. And you believe that, right, Ben?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so I think that like that used to shock people, but we really believe it because society's so dumb, which is why that shocks people now, because society's so far from that. But I think that what happened with a lot of the kind of brutalist libertarians is they still wanted to shock people, and they couldn't shock people because everyone around them was, you know, saying things that were shocking to everybody. So where do you go from there? Well, I guess where they went from there is, you know, let's throw people out of helicopters for disagreeing with us. So,
yeah. You know, I've talked quite a bit about, going back to what we were talking earlier about capitalism, how the word has been tainted. And in a lot of ways, you and I and Nima early on started talking more about markets and the free market and the markets and stuff, because really that's what we're talking about when we talk about capitalism. We're talking about market demand and so forth. And that's the key to killing the state. And that's the key to having freedom, is for people to want it. That's the only way it'll happen. You can't top down it. You can't legislate it. You can't bring it in and force it on people. You can't hold a gun to somebody's head and say, okay, now be free and have fun, because I mean, that's idiotic. But that's what happens when you try to use government to put your version of freedom upon people, whether they want it or not. That's,
yeah,
you know, it's like the there was a thing, I can't remember where it came from, but it was some Nazi sitting, it may have been a cartoon or something, with a Nazi commanding his people to enjoy themselves and have fun.
It's from The Simpsons. It's when the Simpsons have the it's Kent Brockman talking, you know, on the scene at the Simpsons first annual Have a Good Day Festival or something. It was something that Bart ended up helping start by accident. And he said, Brockman says until, you know, he's a reporter on TV on the spot with a microphone and camera crew. And he's saying, and this is a welcome reprise from the usual event we have this week every year, which is it's the Do What You Want Festival. And he says, this is a great reprieve from the usual Do As We Say Festival, founded by German immigrants in 1946.
That's it. Yep. That was it. That's the remnant of the memory I was trying to bring up.
I don't know
up.
Where I pulled that out of, but yeah.
But yeah, that's the ridiculousness of thinking that you can legislate liberty or legislate freedom. It's the exact opposite. And I've heard some of them say, well, yeah, but we have to make steps in that direction. Like for the last 250 years, that's what you've been doing. Yeah. I mean, if elections could bring freedom, then we would have had it a long time ago.
Yeah.
And you look at North Korea, like most people don't realize that there are 5 political parties in North Korea, and there are seated politicians in the North Korean legislature that are considered independent. They're not party related. And they have almost a 100% voting of everybody who's eligible to vote.
I think you have to vote.
Yeah, it's required. And yet they don't have any, they don't have liberty. And if voting could bring liberty, then North Korea would be the freest place in the world. But of course, it doesn't. It brings the opposite. So what you have to do, you have to respond to that by saying that since freedom cannot be legislated, we have to find a way to sell it in the marketplace of ideas. And Buckminster Fuller, you know, he said, you don't change things by forcing that change on to people. You have to produce a product that they want, and then they'll come and get that product. And if you're producing something they don't want, then you need to switch around and produce something else. And I know that's a horrible destruction of the way he actually said it, but the concept was there. It is market driven. And when we have a market for freedom, we will have freedom. The problem right now is we have a giant market for oppression, for the state. People want to be told what to do. They want to be able to blame their problems on the government. They don't want to take responsibility for themselves. And as long as that continues, they're not going to have to take responsibility. They can blame it on the government. It's not my fault. I could do lots of things if I didn't have to pay 70% in, you know, total taxes. Well, yeah, so that means you don't have to give to charity, right? That's right, because the government takes care of the charity. They feed the poor. They do the, but they don't. They do a horrible job of all those things. And so what should we do about it? Well, we should do what's right, and we should stop expecting government to do for us, and we should stop using government as the excuse. And I'll go off on a side rant here as well. This is kind of maybe a taboo topic in a lot of places, but this is the problem with religion. You go to your church, you listen to your minister or your priest or your rabbi or whatever, and he tells you what you're supposed to do, and then and you believe whatever that whatever the guy says, and then you think, all right, I'm good. I went to church. I got, you know, I can check off my bingo card. I went to church. I gave the money. I listened to the preacher or the priest or whatever. He made his magic hand sign at my forehead. He touched some liquid on my tongue, and I'm good. See, I'm covered. It's not my fault. If I can't possibly go to hell now because that guy took care of it for me. And that's the kind of irresponsible notions that cause us, you know, transfer that over to thinking about a government. That's why people accept a government, because they think, well, the government will take care of that. No, the government's not taking, they're doing is filling their own pockets. Those people up there, they don't care about you. They don't care if you're fed or hungry or bombed or anything else. They would bomb you as quick as they're bombing children in Yemen. They don't care. They would take, you know, California. Oh, California is going to exit. California is going to they're going to secede. No, they're not. There's a million strong military in the United States. Like the Civil War was nothing compared to what would happen today if states tried to secede. And they would do it in a heartbeat. They would send in, you would have your own state militia shooting your neighbors, and they wouldn't think a thing about it. They'd be like, yeah, I'm saving the nation. I'm restoring the republic.
Yeah.
How was that for a rant?
That was a great rant. Yeah, your state militia being the, what are they called, National Guard?
Yeah.
State Guard.
National Guard, yeah.
Yeah,
and you know I said this in an article. Go ahead.
The idea that voting can't bring liberty, it really cannot. And if it can at all, it's in the, like, from gross to fine, not the fine to zero. Like, if you I don't think there've been any situations that I know of historically where a populace has voted out a tyrant. You know, like it usually is the result of bloody battles, and I'm not saying a bloody battle is the answer, and you can explain why not. But for instance, we know that socialism is a ridiculous idea, but to somebody living under oppressive communism, socialism looks like a great idea. Or to someone living under a brutal, bloodthirsty tyrant, communism probably looks like a good idea. You know, but the few times the many times in modern history where they have voted out someone really tyrannical and voted in someone less tyrannical in a democratic election, usually the United States steps in and fixes it and gets rid of the democratically elected guy, like in Iran, you know, in the late 70s.
Yep. You know, I used to see, I used to hang out on a lot of gun forums and survival forums and prepper forums and stuff. And you see a lot of hard right-wing people on those, in places like that. And I would see them having serious discussions like, oh, I know so-and-so and so-and-so in the military, and they say that they talk about this a lot, and if they ever get orders to come take our guns, they won't do it. Well, you know, or the other thing is the military will revolt against the D.C. government if the D.C. government gets to. No, they won't. They absolutely won't. They have shown over and over and over that those guys, they obey orders. That's what they do. And think about it like this. You know, we were talking about the National Guard. Kent State, the shooting that took place at Kent State, I think it was in 69, if I recall, you had a situation where you had 19-year-old National Guard, Ohio National Guard soldiers shooting 19-year-old Ohio students. Now, you know, I know that was a long time ago. That was before a lot of people that are listening are alive. But I was alive, and I remember it. I remember the day that that happened and it hit the news, that American soldiers in Ohio, on Ohio soil, shot Ohio students. Now, you just think about that for a minute. The same thing happened in the early 30s when there was a large group of disabled and retired veterans that were trying to get their disability, or their benefits that they had been promised by Washington, D.C. And they were camping out on the mall in Washington, D.C. And so the government's response to this was to call up, what is his name? Not Eisenhower, but MacArthur?
Yeah.
I think it was MacArthur and Patton.
Yep.
Patton brought tanks in, and I think MacArthur was the cavalry at that time. They still had horse cavalry. And they charged through the tent camps that were there, and you know, devastated these veterans. Now, this is active duty military army attacking retired and disabled army.
Being led by, you know, two of the most respected generals in the history of the American Armed Forces.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason why is because military men obey orders. Otherwise, they wouldn't be military men. The the famous quote from, what is that dirty politician that used to be Nixon's Secretary of State? It'll come to me in a minute, but a lot of people recognize the quote. He says, military men are just dumb, stupid animals, and they just do what we tell them, you know? And that's absolutely true. That's what they do. And I'm not bashing the military. Oh, our brave hero. No, you're saying
what the military say about the underlings.
Yeah, exactly. Those guys at the Pentagon, they look at the actual military men as nothing but meat that they can shove into a grinder, and they'll do it without even blinking an eye. Yeah, I read a lot about history and stuff like that, and I get into it a little too much. And you start reading about how somebody like William Tecumseh Sherman or U.S. Grant or even Robert E. Lee, what their real feelings were about their soldiers, they just looked at them as cannon fodder. It was just a big pile of meat to shove at the enemy so that they shoot those guys instead of shooting me. And so they had just horrendous body counts from wars like the American Civil War. It was just horrible because they just shoved these men at each other. And they do the same thing now. They just don't have as high casualty rates on the side of the U.S. because the guys doing the killing are doing it from a trailer in Nevada or somewhere, and they don't have to actually sit there and watch the person, you know, bleed to death. They can look at a monitor and just see the color on the monitor fade as the person bleeds out on the ground. But, you know, it's more like a game, more like an internet game or a computer game than it used to be when soldiers would actually have to stand there and jab their bayonet into the chest of the other guy and then, you know, watch him die right before their eyes. But so they don't even have that emotion.
We're about over time here, and I don't really want to end on this. you know, we're not doing this to a normal show timer. Do you have some redemption in the third act? I hate to cut you off mid-sentence, but it's like, this is just going to, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, the point was made with the first one of them, you know, and then we did three or four more. So, what can people do?
what's the good side?
what can we do? And I say we, meaning not mouse in my pocket, not what can the government make people do, but what can people who listen to what you just said, are crestfallen by it, are bummed out by it, and it sounds hopeless. Why is it not hopeless?
I wish I had this in front of me so that I could read it verbatim. But in my book, I have a thing I call the seven things that we should be doing. We being everybody who's interested in liberty and freedom and so forth. And the first thing on that list is, you know, sometimes you just have to block out the noise and realize that the most important thing you have to do is take care of yourself and your family. That is priority one. Don't worry about who the president is or what the news is going on or what false flag happened here or there that's trying to get your attention or what the Hollywood people are doing. Focus on your family, your friends, your neighbors. Get to know people around you. And this is the biggest impact you can have, is to actually develop the relationships in your life. Excuse me. And, get back. You know, we used to say when I was a kid, the big saying was, love, love, love. All you need is love. And love is, well, yeah, but not really. I mean, you need other things too. You know, you really need to eat some. But if you get down to those basics and you do that stuff first, and you get to the basic principles of not harming others, not doing things that cause somebody else to harm others, and you start just narrowing your life down to stuff that's really important, and you start to understand that all that noise out there in the world and all the stuff that DC's doing and who the president is or what he's up to, and none of that stuff matters. What matters is, what's your family doing? What are the people around you doing? How's your loved ones? How are they doing? What do they have to say? When was the last time you talked to them? That kind of thing.
Yep. And then also, if you get a chance, I'd say try to introduce them to some ideas of liberty, but not at the expense of driving them out of your life or cutting them off.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's important, and you've gone through this in your book, that it is important to remove people from your life that are poisonous, that are mosquitoes and so forth. But at the same time, you can tolerate a lot from people without letting them get under your skin. If you're not dedicated to forcing them all to see things your way, if you're more dedicated to helping them, to serving them and to guiding them and not into pounding them and trying to evangelize them. I think evangelism, the difference between evangelism and sales, I think is key. We shouldn't be evangelists. We should be offering a product, and we should be happy salesmen, but we shouldn't be evangelists just pounding people and relentlessly making them sick with our constant views.
I think we should. I like that. And I think there's also a thing that I've mentioned before. It's a thing from AA, actually, and AA is neither here nor there in this, and I don't go anymore. I used to go a long time ago, but they say that their public relations policy our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, now that libertarianism is becoming so commonplace, I mean, it's kind of a growing pain that we have the luxury of complaining about, you know, these kids today, you know, God bless them, or, you know, cat bless them, that there's so many of them that we can be irritated by a bunch of them. But a lot of them, like, don't behave in a way that would make me want to have what they have if I was new to this, you know?
Right.
So I guess just that's my final closing statement is, you know, try to behave in a way that you have what people want. And then you don't have to sit down and lecture to them. You can just drop a little seed here and there, and then they'll go, hey, you're cool and your life's working out. Tell me more.
Yeah. Yeah. Always leave them wanting more.
And on that note, I think on that note, we're going to go. And I think some other show, we should have you do the other six things you need to do right now. So
I could do that. I'll
dig that out. Yeah. Have you done the show? Have you done on a show before?
No.
All right. Well, it's really great having you back doing shows. I mean, you did a little like early morning, almost just like 15 minute phone call with me once a few months ago. But how long has it been since you've actually done a full episode?
Oh,
two or three years?
I think it's coming up on 2 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's real close to 2 years.
It's great to have you back, man. At least enough. You know, it's great to have both of us back enough that we can sit in a chair and talk without collapsing.
Yeah, and for more than 10 minutes.
Yeah, and I am kind of beat. I'm going to run, but it's great talking to you, brother, man.
Yeah, it's good talking to you too, Michael.
Lots of love, Ben.
Yeah.
Worms.
Worms.
Yeah, so we're not recording anymore. Maybe we are. I don't know. That was nice. I liked doing it like that without the clock, like breathing down my neck. The having the clock. I like the clock on a radio show. I mean, it really like makes a package, a neat little package of a show. But lately, I've been really feeling like it's just like something that's berating me, and like, you know, it's my boss. I don't really want a boss, and the clock is my boss. I don't like being clock blocked, as Lou says.
Yeah, that was Scott Horton was complaining about that about 2 years ago.
And then I think he got rid of it, didn't he?
Yeah, yep. Changed formats.
Yep. Well, I'm also going to have to edit this in some form to where it fits on radio in 8 segments, but I'm going to put it up today as a podcast. I'm at it now. All right, man. I love you.
Hey, love you.
Take care, brother.
Take care of yourself.
Bye. Bye.